Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within 1 square mile of the West End. Today's episode is about Marion Lee Smith, a single mother struggling alone to cope with the daily demands of Derek, her disabled and brain-damaged son. And as frustrated and exasperated as Marion would often be, her death would come about not by exhaustion, but by the hand of her own son. Murder Mile is researched using the original police investigation files. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 43, Marion Lee Smith, The Rich Mum, The Deaf Son, and The Paltry Sum. Today, I'm standing on George Street, W1. And like most places on Murder Mile, it may sound familiar, because we've already been here before, as we're just one road south of the first failed assassination of former Iraqi Prime Minister Abd al-Razak Saeed al-Naif, one road north of the badly bungled abortion of Helen Mary Pickwood, one square west of the Blackout Ripper's first victim, Evelyn Hamilton, and three blocks south of the terrorist tube bombing at Edgware Road. Coming soon to Murder Mile. In front of me is Bryanston Court at 137 George Street, a seven-storey mansion house covering half a square block with brown brick walls, black wrought iron railings, Art Deco lamps, and with four huge Doric columns in chalk stone on either side of the black wooden door. It looks very much like an old bank. Like much of Marylebone, George Street is rather grand, as being named after the most infamous of Britain's mentally unwell monarchs, as it's here that the unfairly dubbed Mad King George III ranted, raved, and recuperated from the debilitating blood disorder known as porphyria. Although this sleepy side street is chock full of five-star hotels, embassies, galleries, and lines of posh cars, like a very literal willy measuring contest. Oddly, for a major metropolitan city, there's no people. It's lifeless, joyless, colourless. Like a potato waffle, coated with caviar. Or like that very white kind of 1980s poodle poop, only sprinkled with lots of pearls. The only life on George Street are those uptight twats in tweed suits who drive their Bentleys at half the speed of a bunged-up slug's bowel movement, and those mummified corpses in mink coats who stink of mothballs and gin and walk a £5,000 fluffy rat and a very posh piece of string. And although, in Bryanston Court, the three-bedroom department of Wallace Simpson recently sold for £5.35 million. It was also here, on the night of Wednesday the 30th of December 1942, in flat 112, that a devoted and well-off mother called Marion Lee Smith was murdered by her own son over the paltry sum of just £2. Life was idyllic for Marion Lee Smith. Raised as a well-mannered, educated, and devoutly religious lady from a wealthy and upstanding family, although a native of Chicago, having married Norman, an executive on the Canadian Pacific Railway, together Marion and her husband would travel the world. By 1920, being birthed in the bustling city of Shanghai in China, as a major international trade port and one of the East's most important financial centres, Shanghai was in its golden age. And being bathed by bright coloured lights, stunned by the hectic buzz of the city, and knocked out by the sweet sizzling smell of steamed crab, beggar's chicken, and shredded duck dumplings, Marion was in her element. And as a 40-year-old globetrotter from a wealthy family, with no commitments or responsibilities, as money was no object, Marion could literally buy anything except happiness. As a hard-working but always exhausted executive, Norman was rarely home. And on the odd occasion he was, the faint cracks in their fractured relationship would show. Often they'd argue, always they'd fight. And so, with fate being so fickle, this was possibly the worst time to have a baby. But on the 21st of August 1922, Marion gave birth to a boy, and she named him Derek. Derek was, and would always be, their only child. And as a happy, normal, and healthy boy, raised to two loving parents in a wealthy family, although he was an accident, Derek was adored. And with his doting mother, smothering her beloved son with endless toys, good food, soft sheets, and a nursemaid at his beck and call, even as a baby, Derek had a better life than most. But then, even in a truly idyllic setting, sometimes accidents do happen. It was a momentary lapse in concentration, as Emma, the family's diligent nursemaid, was distracted for little more than a few seconds. With Derek being a restless two-year-old, unable to sit still, desperate to stand, and struggling to peep out of his pram, as Emma looked away, the adventurous tot crawled over the pram's canvas side. And with no sense of distance or danger, he slipped and fell. The thud was heavy, the cobbles were hard, his head bled. And although motionless, as a pained wail burst from his bloodied lips, which cut the chaotic Shanghai streets to silence, and reassured Emma that the boy was still breathing, Derek was rushed to hospital, having landed on his head. He was lucky, the doctors said, as with no broken bones, only a superficial cut and a few bruises, being given a pill for the pain and a plaster, Marion took her son home and thought nothing more of it. But Derek had been damaged. It started with a stutter, a a simple tripping of the tongue over some troublesome words. Then he became unnaturally clingy, oddly silent, and always cried, as if he was in pain. And as he retreated into his own little world, with his hearing slowly fading, by the age of 12, Derek was totally deaf. With Emma sacked, Marion became Derek's full-time carer, and with his deafness being manageable, having invested in a hearing aid and lip-reading lessons, Marion was coping. But somewhere, deep inside Derek's head, something else had broken. Having relocated to London, limited their social life, and put their globe-trotting days behind them, Derek's demands had placed great strain on his parents' relationship. And although they stayed in touch, Marion and Norman had split. Part funded by her family, Marion moved with her son into flat 112 on the sixth floor of Bryanston Court, a modern, well-furnished, two-bedroom apartment. And as a little family, stuck together in a tiny West End flat, with no one for company but each other, although Marion and Derek were mother and son, to those who knew them, they seemed like an odd mix. 61-year-old Marion was a pale, thin, and hollow version of her former self. And although she was fastidiously neat and elegantly dressed, lacking any smile or sparkle, it seemed as if, every day, a little piece of her soul had drained away. And as a single woman, struggling alone, with a boy whose injuries she blamed on herself, Marion was the epitome of exasperation. Whereas Derek always seemed awkward in his own skin, like a 20-year-old man trapped in a 70-year-old's body. As with a messy mop of black hair perched above his elongated face, a dark crumpled suit which clung to his thin weedy frame, a set of horn-rimmed glasses with lenses like Coke bottle bottoms, so thick they magnified his tiny eyes to the size of saucers. And as his little legs walked with oversized strides, being forced to cart about the clunking great hearing aid with its bulky battery in a carry case. Although he was deaf, delicate, and socially awkward, he was eager for freedom. Not a lot, just some. But with Marion always fussing, huffing, and tutting, as a woman racked with guilt over her broken boy, believing she was a good mum, she had encased him in a cocoon. A cocoon that Derek would never escape, even after he had stabbed his mother to death. In 1942, 3 weeks before Christmas, Marion was at her wit's end. Not from the strict rationing, with the country's food stocks in short supply, the lack of clean water as pipes burst, limiting each flat to just 2 buckets a day, or the barrage of Nazi bombers which night after night rained down death from the skies. But by loving him so much, she had nothing left to give. Every night, they'd fight. And although their little spats were never hurtful, spiteful, or physical, the thin walls of their tiny flat echoed with the sharp sounds of screaming and sobbing, as an exasperated mother and her frustrated son clashed. When Derek was a little boy, although they'd argue, Marion would always win. As being a strong-willed woman, and more importantly, his mother, with just a finger, a look, or even a tut, she could easily override the unruly demands of such a small boy with a slow brain and a stutter. But now, he was a man. Determined that his disability should never hold him back, Derek was educated at some of Britain's best private schools. But being described by his tutors as distant, erratic, distracted, and intellectually deficient, for the third time in the last 6 months, Derek had dropped out of education. And so it went on. He couldn't work, he couldn't earn, and he couldn't learn. Marion was exasperated, exhausted, and alone. She had tried everything, and everything had failed. Even his modest weekly allowance of 12 shillings, which, although not much, was enough to give him some independence. But whereas once, as a boy, he'd spend the lot on sweets, now, as a man, he'd blow the lot on booze, making him deaf, delicate, socially awkward, and also drunk. To Marion, as a devout teetotaler, this was a step too far. And fearing she had lost control, she did the only thing that she could do. She stopped his allowance. And for the last time, the cocoon was shut. And that's how it all began. Not as a bitter battle over inheritance, not as a long-standing feud over love, and not owing to a slow descent into drugs and drink. And although it is said that Derek had been brain damaged, he didn't suffer with headaches, visions, and never heard voices. He was never violent, cruel, or committed a crime. He was just quiet. It all began over a simple spat over a few pennies between a loving mother and her slightly unruly son as she tried to protect him from harm as he tested the boundaries of his newfound freedom. It was an argument which every parent has with their child every day. 3 days before Christmas, like a marvel to the art of multitasking, Marion managed to find the time to establish the St. George's Club at 62 Great Cumberland Place, a social club for members of the armed forces. And although it kept her busy, it also provided her son with a good job, a regular income, and allowed her to keep him busy and close. It seemed like the perfect solution to a small problem. But it wasn't. Wednesday, the 30th of December, 1942, was Marion's last day alive. And yet, like most parents, her morning had begun like any other. As being late for work, she impatiently banged on the bathroom door. It started as a simple squabble over the usual. Her son, having hogged the hot water, made a mess and failed to flush. And that's all. But somewhere in their war of words, Marion hit a nerve, as having merely mentioned that the club's nightly takings were a little short, their sparks erupted into a scuffle. And in a truly rare moment of anger, which shocked them both, Derek struck his mother and stormed out. She wasn't injured, cut, or bruised. If anything, she was just disappointed. Between 9 p.m. and 11 p.m, at the New Inn public house at nearby Marble Arch, Derek sat alone, fuming, as he necked back 4 pints of mild ale. Which was odd, as he hadn't been paid. At a few minutes after 11 p.m, with the club closed for the night, Marion returned home. with the blackout blinds drawn and every light off, the flat was inky black. And although just hours earlier, it was here that Marion and Derek had fought, its silence was eerie, and there was no sign of her son. As was her usual routine, Marion readied herself for bed. On the sofa, she dumped her gloves, purse, and shopping bags. As it was cold, she slipped on a bathrobe, a nightie, a woolen vest, a set of booties, and a scarf. To distract her mind, she sat at the kitchen table, her spectacles on, doing the crossword. And then, with slumber looming, she popped the kettle on the hob, and beside it, a hot water bottle. At 11:20 p.m, Derek returned. And although their tiny flat was filled with a tense trepidation, no words were said, no tuts were uttered, and no looks were exchanged. So seeing that his mother was already dressed and ready for bed, Derek went straight to his bedroom and popped on his pajamas. On his bed lay her brown attaché case. In it was the club's cash boxes, which she'd bring home every night. But it wasn't what it was, what it contained, or where it had been placed which made Derek smile, but what it meant. As still being trusted to count the club's take-ins, this wasn't just her money. It was a symbol of trust, a reconciliation, and one last chance. With a pad and pencil, Derek set about counting the cash. It didn't take him long, not just because he was eager to please his mum, whose pale, drained face beamed with pride from the doorway. But with the club being new, the take-ins were only small and amounted to the paltry sum of just £2. And yet, as she slowly sidled up to thank her son, she smelled the stale stench of booze on his breath. And that's all it took. An accusatory sniff, an exasperated sigh, and a withering look. The disappointed eye roll of a frustrated mother whose trust had been lost. But it was enough to make Derek snap. With a vice-like grip, the loose pale skin of her wrinkled neck folded over his forefingers as both of his hands squeezed her throat tightly. His thumbs embedded into her windpipe, so deep they cut off her air and her screams. As standing over her, with wide staring eyes, her baby boy loomed large. And as her swollen tongue protruded from her pulsating purple face, with her blue lips agog, like her last ever words were trapped in the midst of a silent scream, as her whole world slowly went black, Derek let go. Marion gasped for air, gulping down great mouthfuls of oxygen as her pallid complexion returned. In court, Derek described this as a moment of temporary insanity. He just wanted to frighten his mother, and frightened she was. But as he stormed out of the bedroom, he knew he'd done wrong. Having taken the wailing kettle off the hob, Derek stood in the kitchen, his breathing staggered, his eyes flooded with tears. As being both terrified and ashamed of the truly awful act which he had done to his mum with his own hands, hearing her sobs echo from the bedroom. To steady his nerves, Derek decided to fix himself a lime juice and ginger ale. And as he opened the cutlery drawer, his quivering hand hovering near the bottle opener. Behind him, in the bedroom, he heard the distant crinkle of notes and the faint clink of coins being counted as his mother checked the cash box for theft. And in that instant, Derek went from shame to rage. With her back to the bedroom door, she didn't hear her son return. With her head facing the bed, she couldn't see him rush up behind her. And being so focused on counting the club's nightly takings, Marion didn't see that in the hand of her baby boy, he held a 4-inch black-handled kitchen knife. The first thing she felt was a hard thump, like she'd been punched in the back, the force having shoved her forward into the bed, and feeling a warm trickle as blood ran down her spine. As she turned and saw her own knife, last used to slice spuds, sunk deep into her back, right up to the handle, as her left lung slowly pooled with blood, Derek retracted the blade and stabbed his mother again. The second stab wound sliced 1 inch deep into the purple skin of her bruised neck, severing her larynx. And with the pleural cavity of her left lung now collapsed, being unable to breathe as she choked on her own blood, Marion slipped into shock, frozen in fear. Slowly, she began to bleed to death. And as she turned to look into the eyes of her killer, the last sight Marion saw was her own son, as with his hand held high, gripping a bloodied knife, with every ounce of hate, spite, and hurt, he stabbed her once in the face, slicing open her lower lip and chin, right down to the jawbone. A moments later, 61-year-old Marion Lee Smith, mother of Derek, was dead. At 9:15 a.m. the next morning, Marion's body was discovered by their housekeeper. The crime scene wasn't difficult for Detective Inspector Clare to deduce, as with one dead body, an empty cash box, a locked door, her son missing, his fingerprints on the knife, and his blood-splattered pajamas soaking in the sink, having been seen by the night porter walking out of Bryanston Court barely moments after her screams had died. With Derek as the police's only suspect, his description was issued to all stations. With £2 in his pocket, Derek finally got the freedom he had dreamed of. But with those few stolen notes adding up to little more than £90 today, by 6:30 p.m, being broke, sober, and totally distraught, he handed himself in to the police, stating in a mumbled stutter, "The only thing I can say at my trial is I am guilty." Except he didn't. On the 16th of March 1943, in a 2-day trial at the Old Bailey, a tearful Derek pleaded not guilty to murder, but guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. And with neither the defence nor the prosecution protesting those findings, with two doctors having confirmed that Derek had a psychopathic personality disorder, an erratic heart rate, and abnormal brain waves, consistent with an undiagnosed brain injury when he fell from a pram, aged 2. The jury retired for just 1 hour and 40 minutes, before they returned with the unanimous verdict of guilty, but insane. In a statement spoken by his solicitor, Derek said, I'm very sorry I did this awful thing. I have done the greatest of harm by disposing of my best friend in life. Derek was sentenced to be detained at His Majesty's pleasure, which he served at Broadmoor Psychiatric Prison. And although the protective cocoon of his loving mother was created to shield her deaf, delicate, and socially awkward son from danger, for the sake of a paltry sum, this one night of freedom had left Marion dead, and Derek, trapped inside a very different kind of prison, forever. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. Don't forget, if you're a murky miler, to stay tuned for extra goodies after the break. A big thank you goes out this week, not just to my regular listeners and new listeners, but also my Patreon supporters, who this week are Mark Williams and Alison Lee. A big thank you, Mark and Alison. I'm donating to both of you one of my livers. So it's up to you what you want to do with it. Either you can sell it, give it to a donor, grill it, fry it, sauté it, or, given that it's only 10% blood, but at least 90% Jack Daniels, if I was you, I'd drink it. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult with No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Murky Milers! Hello, Murky Milers. Welcome to Extra Mile. How are you doing? You all well? You having a nice day? Hope you are. Obviously, I can't hear you reply back to me, but I'm sure you are. If not, if you are having a nice day, just say right now, say yes, I'm having a nice day. Or turn to the person next to you and say to them, are you having a nice day? That'd be nice, wouldn't it? Obviously, if we all talked to each other more, life would be so much better. But when you turn to a stranger anywhere now, they think you're a weirdo. This is Extra Mile. This is the unscripted, unedited part of the show where we talk about the case that has just happened. I fill you in with extra details. There's no sound effects. There's no music. There's no blah, 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 blah. It's basically just me waffling. It's full of mistakes. So I'll trip over my tongue a couple of times, but it doesn't get edited out. This stays exactly as it... Oh, I burped. That would get edited out. I burped. That stays in. So it's not compulsory. If you're new to Extra Mile, you don't need to listen to this, but a lot of people do enjoy it. And I enjoy it as well, because it's therapeutic. After the hard work that goes into the first part, which takes months to research and 60 to 70 hours a week to write, or longer as this episode took, Extra Mile takes, all it takes is as long as it takes for me to record it, which is great. It's quite therapeutic, actually. So that was a story of Marion Scott Lee Smith and her son, Derek Thayer Lee Smith. Obviously, their little flat was just around the corner of from Montague Square, where the first victim of the Blackout Ripper was murdered, and just around the corner from Maison Lyonnaise as well, where the Blackout Ripper picked up his first victim, that we reckon, and where Helen Mary Pickroad and the bungled abortion with Captain Tickle was as well. So these are all in kind of Marylebone area, which is just west of Soho. So this is in one of our other square miles. Obviously, we've got a few square miles now because there's lots of murders in Soho, but I want to kind of jazz it up a bit. I don't want us to get stuck in the same streets too often. So we've now got, what have we got? We've got Soho Murder Mile. We've got Fitzrovia, which includes one of the Blackout Ripper's victims, the Swedish lady, the student who was murdered, what was her name? Martine Vik Magnusson. So I knew Magnusson was in there somewhere. And the Charlotte Street robbery, and there'll be some more as well. And obviously, sorry, I'm keeping an eye out because I've got the kettle on. I'm making a cup of tea. I'm watching the kettle very closely. And obviously we've got Marylebone, which also includes Edgware Road area. Kettle's about to go. I'm disappearing. I'm getting... There you go. I got one of those old kettles where you put it on the gas hob and then it screams at you. There we go, cup of tea. Obviously, because I live on a boat, I don't have a fridge. So I haven't got proper milk. So I have to have powdered milk. I know, a bit yucky. But there we go. Milk, two sugars, and a tea. And I'm treating myself with a little cake as well, because I feel like I need it this morning. Because this was an early start. This was not... Normally I start recording at about 7 a.m. I couldn't sleep last night, so I got up at 4. So this is... it's not quite dawn yet. So I probably sound a bit... I probably sound weird on this podcast, but... yeah, I'm either tired or lacking sleep. So yeah, Motor Miles, what we've got. We've got Soho, we've got Fitzrovia, we got... Marylebone, which covers Paddington area and Edgware Road. And I think as of next week, I will be throwing in Covent Garden as well, because it's quite a good hub of information and stories. Do you know, I've got a very sad story next week, but there's also, if you've heard of Burke and Hare, who obviously the Scottish gentleman, not originally from Edinburgh, but they mostly based out of Edinburgh, who stole corpses to sell for medical research and then started committing murders to sell off even more corpses. Covent Garden had its own version of them, who have basically been hidden. So I'm going to include Covent Garden now, so we can include those. There's also a vague, interesting murder about a guy who tries to commit a robbery and accidentally shoots himself in the face. Happy days. And we've got another one as well. There's a famous murder in Covent Garden, which all the tourists, tour guides go on about, but it's so boring, and the only reason they do it is because this guy's meant to be famous. He was like the Brad Pitt of his day, and it's just such a boring murder. So I'm going to include that one so I can take the piss, ha ha ha. So let's dive in. I mean, for me, there's no such thing as boring murders. What I do try, as you know, what I try to do with Murder Mile is not go into all these sensational murders. There's too many documentaries out there where people go, oh, there was a man and he kidnapped all of these women and he kept them in a cellar which he converted into a torture dungeon and he cut their heads off. And it's like, oh, that's easy to write. Anyone could write that. You don't need to have any skills to sit down and talk about a murder in which someone cut someone's head off. The more sensational the details, the less work you have to do. Whereas what I'm trying to do with Murder Mile is show you, and this episode is a prime example, that you can have murders which are very unsensational, but if you dive down into them, they're very normal. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that people are kind of distancing themselves by focusing on these big sensational cases. So the cases where they go like the toolbox murderer, the toolbox killer and things like that. When it's a serial killer, it's sensational and you're distancing yourself away from it because the chance of you meeting a serial killer is remote. Whereas this story here, this is like most murders. And this is why most people ignore them, because they think, oh, it's boring, it's a domestic. But this is exactly what most murders are. It's mother and son, it's father and daughter, it's husband and wife. It's, you're more likely to be murdered by someone you know. And that's what I'm trying to get across with these episodes, is by taking a very normal murder, nothing too sensational, and just going, oh my God, look, it's family, it's friends, it's not... You're not gonna have someone walk up to you off the street who you've never met before and just decide they want to kill you. If you're going to be killed, you're going to be killed by someone you know. And that's what I'm trying to get with these episodes. So they're deliberately not sensational. I will throw in some sensational ones just for the hell of it. But what I really want to get across is the idea that it is very normal murders. I think they're more interesting. And also it gives me a reason to dive deep into the characters to find out where they come from and what they're about. So, ooh, cup of tea in front of me. Very nice. And a Bakewell tart, which I will munch into shortly. So I got distracted looking at Bakewell tart. It's a nice... It's a cupcake version, so it's the size of a cupcake. If you don't know what a Bakewell tart is, it's... this one is the size of a cupcake. It's round. It's got... shortcrust pastry on the outside, so it's quite hard, but when you bite into it, it goes all crumbly. And on the top is icing with a little glacé cherry. And when you go through that, you got next, which is the frangipane. I love frangipane. I know it's so sweet, but I love frangipane. Frangipane, so it's like a mixture of sponge and marzipan, so it's a very sweet sponge. And then underneath is kind of it's either a strawberry or raspberry jam. God, I love Bakewell tarts. Oh, God. I would probably have my last meal as Bakewell tart. No, Chinese food. Love Chinese food. cheese on toast. Good cheese on toast with some Worcester sauce on top and a Bakewell tart. And, of course, a cup of tea. Right. Oh, dear, that was good. Right, extra mile. Couple of things in the story that I left out, because obviously we don't have time to put everything in and it slows down the story. So quite a lot of stuff I leave for this section, which is good. So for those of you who are patient, have waited to the end, this is the extra stuff that you're waiting for. Exciting. Not just me talking about Bakewell tarts and tea. So motive for the theft. Now, we had mentioned in there that Derek was, because he'd been doing a bit of typing, he'd also been doing a bookkeeping course, one of the many courses he'd tried, but he couldn't really stay focused when he was at education. His mum had paid a lot. His mum and her family had actually paid, even though he hadn't got any qualifications, his family had actually paid for him to go to Trinity College in Cambridge, which is one of the, you know, going to Cambridge University, you have to have fantastic grades to get in there. Thick people like me couldn't get in. I had to go to a shitty university in South Wales. they actually paid. I mean, it was serious money, and they paid good money because he at that point he was interested in geography. So they paid for him to go on to do a degree in geography. He lasted just under 8 months. He didn't last very long. So he'd done that. He'd done a typing course at Pittman that I mentioned. He'd also done a bookkeeping course to be an accountant. He'd given up on that. But his mum still believed in him. And she was like, because she's running the St. George's Club, she said, you can do the bookwork. Now, looking at the details, she seems like a clever lady. It's highly likely that she'd already done the bookwork herself, but she was giving her boy something to do to keep him occupied and to make him feel good and kind of that he had value, because he was being rejected by everyone because he was, as everyone said, he was slow-witted. Obviously there was an argument over a loss of funds. It's still unsure whether it looks like he'd taken some cash out of the cash box, but also there seemed to be a problem with people cashing in paychecks. Now, in those days, especially armed forces, because it was a government check, basically, in those days, if you were paid by cheque, which most people were, because there wasn't bank transfer, you'd either get paid in a little wallet with money in it. I remember those days. Or being paid by cheque, you could basically go anywhere. You could go to a post office, or you could go to most bars and say, "This is my work cheque. Can you cash that?" And they'll go, "Yeah, fine. It's £4. I can cash that. I can give you the cash back because it's government covered. You know, it's all legal. But there did seem to be a problem with checks that weren't valid. So whether he'd cashed some invalid checks or whether someone else had and he just hadn't checked, we don't know. But there was a bit of a motive there for... So it wasn't just him stealing £2. There was other money that had gone missing as well. I mentioned in there earlier on that her body had been found. Marion's body had been found. Now, because Marion had deliberately... she decided that when Emma had looked away and baby Derek had fallen on the floor and injured his head, after that moment she said she was never going to let anyone ever look after her children ever again. She was going to become a full-time mum, which she did, so she sacked Emma. But she did have domestic help after that. So she had a lady who was a housekeeper called Rose Hambly. Now, we get a lot of the details about the original argument that happened in the bathroom. So do you know when I said that it was the morning of the morning when Marion was murdered, so about 16 hours prior. She was trying to get in the bathroom. Derek was in the bathroom having a bit of a bath. She couldn't get in. There was a bit of domestic. They had a bit of a falling out over money. All of this we know because Rose was there at the time. She turned up that morning to do the cleaning. She would prepare breakfast for Marion and her son, but neither of them had breakfast that morning. So on New Year's Eve, which is the 31st of December 1942 at 9:15 p.m., Rose Hambly, she had her own key. She came into flat 112, which was Marion and Derek's. She took off her coat. She hung it by the spare bedroom, which was Derek's bedroom. Everything was in darkness. The blinds were still drawn. The breakfast tray was still out. Nothing had been touched. Obviously, Marion's newspaper and glasses were still on the table. The hot water bottle was out. That's why we know all of these details, because she hadn't touched anything. She looked in Marion's bedroom and the bed had not been slept in. And obviously, the kettle was ready to put in, but by then it had gone cold. The flat was entirely silent. She walked into Marion's bedroom, saw that her undergarments were on the chair and like her gloves and handbag were on the couch and the shopping bags and all that. And then she noticed that there was a light on in Derek's bedroom, and she opened up the door and then she saw Marion's body on the floor and immediately ran out and informed the hall porter, who in turn called the police. So that's how we know. So if she hadn't turned up that morning to do her duties, we probably wouldn't have known that she was dead until Derek had gone to the police. So the detective in charge of this case was, I mentioned, was burps again. Whew. Was Detective Inspector Leonard Clare, actually Divisional Detective Inspector Leonard Clare, who's a name you'll recognise from the Blackout Ripper. Because we're dealing in the same area and there's around the same period of time, there's a lot of detectives who are doing the same. So he'd wrapped up the Blackout Ripper case like barely 8 months before this. So this was probably a bit of relaxation for him, although there was a lot of murders in between this as well. So he arrived that morning. He arrived at flat 112. He saw Marion on the floor, lying on the back, blood all over the room, copper coins on the bed. There were two cash boxes on the bed, one which was open, one was closed. One of them hadn't got the key for it. That's why they couldn't open it. So Derek, there was another cash box, but Derek couldn't get into it. And the attaché case was open as well. Marion was wearing her dressing gown and a nightdress and booties underneath. And underneath her left shoulder was what they called the black peeling knife. So it's a small knife that she was stabbed with. It was about 4 inches long. She'd used it for peeling vegetables or potatoes, as it was actually the night before. There's a large quantity of blood on the floor. And then when he went into the study, he found Derek's pajamas stained with blood, which was in the wash basin. And spots of blood around the sink as well. So he knew straight away that who had done it, what had happened. It was one of those crime scenes that he just walked in and just went, yep, know exactly what it was. So Derek's identity had been sent out to all the police stations. Where is the... Why haven't I put that here? This is... I've taken something out. That's weird. I was going to Okay, well, that's fine. I can memorise it. So Derek was actually going down the Admiralty on Whitehall. So basically, he was walking down the route between where 10 Downing Street is and Houses of Parliament is. So he was in the centre of town. He'd gone down Trafalgar Square and he's walking down down Whitehall in that area. He was outside the Admiralty. There was obviously some police stationed there. He was trying to find his way to New Scotland Yard, which is not too far away. It's probably about a quarter of a mile away. He wanted to give himself up. He went to a constable who was there and said, can you tell me the way to New Scotland Yard? Derek's details had already been given to all the police. The policeman shined the torch into his face. Derek was easy to spot. He was short. He was awkward. He had big, thick glasses. He was wearing a hearing aid with a carry case on his hip. He was not difficult to identify at all. Policeman basically said, can I see your ID? Everyone has to carry ID. It was wartime. Derek showed his ID that said Derek Thayer Smith. And the policeman basically just said, I'm going to have to take you in over the death of your mother. And that was it. He was taken straight to Paddington Police Station. So at 7:30 p.m. that night, he was questioned at Scotland Yard first. Then he went to Paddington Police Station. He confirmed his name, asked for his whereabouts that night. He said he had a night out, but said he'd had a couple of pints. I took this out of the story because it just throws everything off. But he said, after he'd finished work, he had a night out, he had a couple of pints, he had 4 pints of ale, and then he had a complete blackout. He doesn't remember anything after that, so he doesn't remember the murder at all. But he knew he was guilty, and he even said to Detective Inspector Clare, I suppose this means the rope. So, obviously, because he committed murder, he knew that he was probably going to be executed. Although he wasn't going to be executed for that, because he firstly... he did, because it was... murder in furtherance of a robbery. So even though he hadn't shot his mother, yeah, no, he could have been... If he hadn't have been found insane, he would have been executed. I'm sure he would have been Albert Pierpoint's, one of his next ones. Interesting note here, he did say... Derek did say, I suppose this means the rope. Don't think this is because of what's in her will. I'll go into that in a bit. He was remanded in custody. Derek was. He was sent to Brixton Prison while he was on remand on New Year's Day 1943. And he was examined by Dr. Hugh Grierson, who we've heard of many times before. George Pickering case. He was the medical officer who dealt with George Pickering, which is kind of interesting. We've now had two murderers in the same series who have both been deaf. George Pickering, who was deaf owing to... It was meningitis in the early age, and then this was deafness due to a fall. So Hugh Grierson was medical officer at Brixton Prison. He observed Derek in hospital, did a quick family history, and found that there was a prior history of insanity in the family. He had one paternal aunt who was an epileptic, and who was... A high functioning mental defective. So that's on his father's side. And then he had a maternal aunt on his mother's side. I'm pointing that out just in case you don't know what paternal or maternal means. Just in case. And his maternal aunt was declared insane and died in an asylum at Wauwatosa. See, that's why I haven't put it in the script. Wauwatosa Sanatorium in Wisconsin. Her name was Miss Mabel Key, and she suffered from delusions and hallucinations. And she was obsessed with the idea of relatives stealing her money, and she was devoutly religious. Not that I'm saying that they're connected, but that's what they're saying in there. So I mentioned briefly at the end that the two doctors had said that he had psychopathic tendencies, and they'd done tests on him, so kind of his heart rate and his brain EKG. So these two doctors were Captain Leo Rao and Dr. J.D.N. Hill. J.D.N. Hill. He must really hate his first names to have done that. They stated that because Derek had low blood sugar, this meant that he had no control over his impulse to commit certain actions. but agreed that he knew what he was doing when he murdered his mother, and that he knew that it was wrong. So they took him to Sutton Hospital, which is in South London, to be examined by doctors. They stated that he suffered from hypoglycemia, obviously a shortage of blood sugar, which impaired his ability to control his actions. Dr. Hill conducted a series of tests using an electroencephalogram to test his brain waves. I can barely say these words. And they proved that he had abnormal brain waves and also brain spasms as well. So obviously this was caused by damage when he landed on his head as a child. But obviously those doctors back in the 1920s, they didn't see any of this at all. They were just like, he's just got a bit of a cut. But obviously there must have been swelling in the brain. It must have caused contusions and injuries to his brain. In another test, Dr. Hill actually gave Derek four pints of mild ale, as if the stuff that he had drank that he said he drank, and then retested his blood sugar level. And they did another test as well and denied him breakfast just to see if there was the same balance as well. And it came across as roughly the same. They said that he had a severe drop in blood sugar and he was unable to really judge kind of right and wrong. Also, he was drunk as well. They had said in here that he'd only really drank twice in his life. Obviously, he didn't really have a lot of friends. So he didn't really do a lot of drinking except by himself. And to be honest, he wasn't a big drinker. It was antisocial. It was kind of when he could escape from his mum, really. In Marion's will, when she died, there was £5,482. Which, when you consider that, about a pound was worth about £30 today, that's a lot. So you're gonna have to times that by 30. But that's a big old chunk of money. So that was left in her will. Unfortunately, it didn't go to Derek because he was declared insane and was committed at His Majesty's pleasure to be detained in Broadmoor Psychiatric Prison. He never got any of this. This went to Marion's husband instead, because even though they were separated, they were still married. I did a bit of a... there was nothing in the police file about what happened to Derek afterwards, but interestingly, so he was detained at His Majesty's pleasure, which basically means it's a life sentence, but up until the point that... they say His Majesty's pleasure, but the king really doesn't give a shit about it. It's basically doctors, really. Doctors make a decision how long he needs to stay there. Derek actually left Broadmoor, so he was in there in 1943. I haven't been able to find details about when he was released, but he was released, and he married in 1969. So he was... what was that? He would have been 47 by that point. Good bit of math by me then. He married a lady called Amy Derrick. They were married in the borough of Haringey, which is northeast London. But I have not been able to find a date of death. So, either he went overseas, because he was born in China, therefore he probably had dual citizenship, or given the fact that both his parents were American, he may have moved to America, which means he may have died over there, but I haven't been able to find that. Or, if he is still in this country and he's still alive, he would be 96 years old. All of which are possible. So we don't know. So, unfortunately, what happened to Derek, I don't know. I would love to know. I just don't know. He's kind of gone missing. I thought I'd throw this in as well. This was going to go into the story, but I decided to take it out just because I wanted this to be about... Sorry, I'm having a stretch. Oh, yawn. I hope I'm not making you yawn. I took this out of the story just because I wanted to make it Marion's story, and I just did some of these things kind of slowed down the story a bit. So, but you often hear people going on about... the good old days of the war, wartime, when it was the good old days and all the neighbours looked out for each other. Now, I know we always say this is rose-tinted spectacles, but it is. It's like the amount of murder cases that I look through and then I look at people's witness statements and I just think it's absolute bollocks, all of this. Oh, do you know, we all looked out for each other. And I'll give you good examples here. So, we've got a statement here by a lady called Kate Holman, who lived in 116 Bryanston Court. So she lived in the flat immediately above, and she said at 11:40 p.m. on the 30th of December 1942, she was in bed and she was woken by a short terrible scream, followed by a long agonising scream, and then shortly after that she heard the sounds of footsteps running away. Okay, and at the same time there were other people in the flats who heard the screams as well, including Major Don, who was a retired major who used to work in the army. Him and his wife were one floor below and heard the screams as well. He armed himself with his service revolver. He went outside onto the floor. He checked the floor, but he didn't approach a flat. He didn't approach flat 112 at all to check if Marion was okay, even though that's where the screams came from. So we've got two witness statements by two people here who heard blood-curdling screams, the sound of someone being murdered, and yet they did nothing about it. That doesn't sound like people looking out for each other. Really. It seems like people today in a big city who would... the difference today is people will come out with their mobiles, wouldn't they? They'd come out with their phone and film it, but they wouldn't do anything about it. So, So people heard the sound of Marion dying, but obviously they did nothing about it and she wasn't discovered until the morning. And then all of a sudden they were all surprised. They were like, oh my God, someone was murdered in the flat. And it was like, yes, of course there was. And you heard her get murdered. Oh, dear. Anyway, so those were the extra details to do with that case. Hope you enjoyed that. This was a really difficult one to write. Normally, I can write an episode in about 3 days. This one took about six. It's a real pain in the arse, this one. Just to let you know how I kind of write, none of these details are in like a court document. None of these details are kind of in a police file. You don't open a police file and there's like a chronology of a person's life, their whole history, and a big list of what their personality traits is. These things just don't appear there. When a lot of these documents, because they want to, like court documents, what they want to prove is whether someone committed a murder or not. A lot of these documents are very factually written. So it says, on this day, at this time, this person saw this person walk in there. They were wearing these clothes. And that's all it is. You get very little about personality. And that's what I really want, is to learn about a person so you can learn about their life and what they're like. And then you can see the murder from their perspective. So what I have to do is I go through all the documents, all the case files, all the court documents. I go through it and then I check, find out what the murder's about. And I write all that up, and then I go through the case files again very carefully, and especially the witness reports, and I go through that very carefully, and I try and find little details which are important. So things like, in this case with Derek Lee Smith, like, there were details in there about how he was dressed. So he had a kind of a messy mop of hair on his head, so it's messy hair. He had thick glasses, Coke bottle bottoms, so he had bad eyesight. Obviously he wore a hearing aid. He was short. He was only about 5'7", but he walked with long strides. So a lot of this is all telling you about how awkward he is. He's quite a socially awkward person. Do you know, we're able to find out what kind of courses he was interested in. So he did accountancy and geography, things like that. So it's those kind of details that I kind of root out to try and find, to kind of write these episodes. But a lot of these files were really difficult. It was like you had to find witness statements and then find people who knew them for years, and then they go, Marion had, you know, occasionally she'd meet friends with bingo for bingo, and you go, ah, okay, bingo, that's important. It all helps. It's all these tiny details that help build up a bigger picture of the true person. Because in these files, these things just don't exist. You have to go and write them. My brain's gone today. I was going to say something, then I realised I've already discussed it earlier on. I know. This script actually took a lot longer to write, and it's because I got halfway through it, because I think I'd written it from Derek's perspective, and Derek's perspective isn't, I don't know, it just didn't sit right. It just didn't sit right with me at all, because it's kind of like, he doesn't know why he's done it, but he's not mad. He's not mad. He's declared insane, but he's not madman. Do you know? He's not running around with a knife going, I'm a madman. Stab, stab, stab. And I tried to write it from both their perspectives, because it is really a fight between a mother and son, but it really didn't come across. And it took me ages to work out that I had to write this episode from Marion's perspective instead. That this really is a story about a loving mother alone doing her best to try and do the best for her son. And even whether he's disabled or not, it kind of goes through the story that actually this becomes irrelevant after a while, because it's really not about the fact that he does have disabilities. That really is, it's just a mother and son. That's all it is. It's a very normal murder. I kind of set it up at the start where you think, oh God, you know, he's been dropped on his head. He's probably going to go insane, and he's mad, and he goes crazy by this point. But he doesn't. Literally, it causes him to go deaf. It may have caused him his eyesight problems, but he didn't seem to suffer from headaches or anything like that, or delusions or anything like that. It's literally, it ended up being a story about a child, man, boy, who basically just wanted more freedom, really. So, quite a normal murder, something that can happen to anyone. I thought, I'd do a little shout out at this point. I was thinking this week, do you know, people say, because obviously all the kids are going back to school, I was thinking, people always say, do you know, you can remember good teachers. So I thought I would do a little shout out to one of my old school teachers. It was a lady called Mrs. Valerie Perrin. She was my English teacher, and I, do you know what, at school I didn't really enjoy English. Not because of her, I just, do you know what, the syllabus around that time was all, oh, do you know, the classic books, I'm using inverted commas, the classic books that everyone hates. Do you know, you're forced to listen to Shakespeare, and you're forced to, oh, read stuff like Jane Eyre and things like that. Do you know, crap where basically people just, it's like a tussle between whether someone posh is going to marry someone posh, and you just don't give a shit. And it's stuff like that, but she was a really good teacher. A Cornish lady with dark hair and very huge boobs. she was obsessed with telling stories about brunette Cornish girls with huge boobs, which I have to say, as a teenage boy, I found that imagery very good. But the reason why I'm flagging her up is because she, with her English lessons, she would always say, like, if we were writing something and writing a story, she would say, okay, never say the word said. Okay, because there's about 1,000 different ways that you can say the word said. And she's absolutely right. So you don't say John said this, you say John emoted this, John requested. You know, there's a lot of different ways. And I find that it's a lesson I still use today in my head, that I try never to say said. I always try and find other words around it. Hence, in a sentence, you'll notice that sometimes if I say, like, I'm on Old Compton Street, and in the next word I have to have the word street in there, I'll try and use the word road or alley or cut through, or I'll try not to repeat the same word, because it annoys me when people do that, when they use the word like house three times in the same sentence. Whereas you can, you know, I just find it boring and dull. And you know what? She was a really good teacher as well. I never really liked English at school. I really struggled with it. But she did me the biggest favour ever. I was around that time of school, so I was probably around 13 or 14, you know, the difficult age. I was struggling. I wasn't really a good student. I was getting D's and E's and U's even. And I was with a bad crowd. And she knew that, and she could see that, and she could see that I wasn't a bad student. I was just, you know, in with a bad crowd and wasn't really concentrating. I get distracted very easily. So what she did the best thing that I think anyone's ever done for me, really, is she didn't split me up and from the bad people I was with and make an example of me. What she did, she took me to one side. She told me she was going to do this. She said, look, you, I know you're a good lad. And I know I don't want you to feel out of place here. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to move everyone. So as of next week, I'm going to shift everyone around and you're going to be moved as well. But no one will notice that that is what I've done. And this, I mean, I know this was a thing that she wanted to do because she wanted to split other people up as well. But she sat me with some other lads who I knew who were really good. They were like A and B students. And over the course of the year, my grades really improved because I had a chance to sit and concentrate. So, yeah, do you know, they do say that you get good teachers and you remember them. And I certainly do. What else? So Blackout Ripper, I thought I'd so I've got some notes here, but I've badly written them today. So Blackout Ripper, obviously we did the Blackout Ripper end of season one. I did mention in there that he had potentially murdered two other women. I put in freedom of information request to get those police files declassified. Unfortunately, that has been denied, which is a little bit upsetting because I was hoping to get the original files. There's only a couple of years left, but it's still 3 or 4 years out of 75. And I was like, come on, guys. But they were like, no, they haven't given a reason, so I can't get access to those police files yet, which is really annoying. But this is kind of interesting. I was contacted a couple of days ago. I can't go into too many details about it at the moment, but I was contacted by the Blackout Ripper's grandson. I know, this is interesting. He's just found out about it himself. He's just found out that he's the Blackout Ripper's grandson. He's contacting me for more information because obviously I did the series and I spoke to him on the phone, really nice guy. He's digging up loads of information at the moment because obviously he knows the families relatively well. I'm still doing research to find out these new cases. So hopefully I'm going to meet up with Blackout Ripper's grandson soon. And we'll take it from there. So there will be more information about the Blackout Ripper. Do you know what? Whether I do another Murder Mile episode or whether I just do a conversation with his grandson, just so we can fill in some details, that'd be great. But I thought you might like that. I'm going to throw this in here. Now, you'll probably think I'm mad for doing this because obviously you know I'm exhausted writing these episodes because it's like 60 to 70 hours a week writing and producing these episodes and researching on top of that, and I am knackered at the moment and running out of time. But I'm thinking about setting up another podcast as well. Now, it won't be a podcast like Murder Mile, which is quite intense and, you know, well researched and well written, but it's a real HF, a real head fuck, if I'm honest. I enjoy it, but it's just really hard work, Murder Mile is. But also, I don't want to do something which is like Extra Mile, which is kind of, you know, it's kind of free form, but it's unplanned and it's a bit of a mess. I don't want to do something like that. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do a daily podcast. I know you're thinking I'm mad. A daily podcast, but a really short one. So basically 3 minutes long. And the idea is that you can listen to it every day. It doesn't have to be a demand. You can binge them if you want to. But you can listen to them while you're eating your toast in the morning or having a poo or, you know, literally anything. While you're having your fag waiting for the bus, a cigarette for the bus. Obviously, having a fag for a bus probably means something else in America. So it's a short one. But the idea is basically loads of people out there love true crime podcasts. Lots of words are used, but very few people understand what the words mean. So what I want to do is, like, it's it's basically a daily nugget every day, where every day I say, okay, word of the day is execution. And then I tell you where the word execution comes from or what it's about. And it's just 3 minutes. So basically you can go into work that day or wherever you are. And if it crops up in conversation, you can go, oh, do you know what the difference between a coffin and the casket is? Do you know what defense straight means? Do you know where the origins of the word murder comes from? Little things like that. Do you know why do we call it an autopsy? Where does the word mortician come from? Do you know, little things like that. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to try and kick that off in sometime in October. That'll be a daily thing. Only be 3 minutes long, but that's the thing. So I'm struggling with a name at the moment. I can't quite work out a name for it. So if you guys fancy, message me, email me, whatever. All is good. This is just between us at the moment. But I was thinking deathtionary, a mixture of death and dictionary. But the word dictionary does put people off, as does the word lexicon. So it really is kind of a daily dictionary about death and murder. It's not just true crime. It's death, murder, it's true crime. It's kind of everything associated with that. I'm toying with the idea of death nuggets. Because that's really boils down what it is. It's about death, but it's kind of a daily nugget of information. So that's what I'm kind of think of. So yeah, no, if you can think of any names that might go with that, let me know. Whiz them over to me. That would be lovely. Yeah, I can't think. I was also thinking murder words, because I like the way it phrases murder words. Although the problem is, when you use words like murder and true crime in a search engine for podcasts, it kind of gets disappeared, because so many people like myself use the word murder and true crime. So yeah, if any of you know of any, can think of any names for that, whiz them over. Yeah. That'd be lovely. Anyway, that is the end of Extra Mile. That was a relatively long record. I'm going to finish my tea. I have got a cherry Bakewell right in front of me that looks absolutely delicious. Oh, look at that. I'm going to tuck it that way. I will demolish that. That wouldn't fit in my mouth, but I will make sure it fits in my mouth in one go. That is delicious. Cool. Thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile and Extra Mile. Thank you so much to everyone who's left reviews on iTunes and all. I've just seen some lovely ones on CastBox. I never checked CastBox, but I just haven't. So thank you to everyone who's posted them on there. There's another podcast platform. I've forgotten it. But yeah. No, so thank you to everyone. Hope you enjoyed the episode. And we'll be back next week with more Murder Mile goodness. No song this week. Sorry about that. Have a good day. Be good. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.